Module 3 is Identifying and Analyzing Risks. This covers Chapter 3 in the textbook, so let's go ahead and get out our study sheet. And as you can see, we're going to spend essentially the first half of this module talking about risk identification and the holistic approach to risk identification. We'll also talk about the team approach to identifying risks, some different strategies where a group of people can get together as a team to identify risks. We'll also talk about risk analysis. We'll start, though, by talking about holistic risk identification, identifying risk as a team, and then we'll focus the rest of the module on risk analysis. We'll talk about the risk analysis process, accident analysis, and we'll wrap up by talking about root cause analysis. Let's start off, though, by talking about holistic risk identification. Traditionally, risk management has involved the prevention of property damage and injuries. In other words, traditionally, risk management has focused on hazard risk. But let's go ahead and get our handout out for risk quadrants, because under the holistic approach, we're not just looking at hazard risk. We're looking at a broader scope of risks. We're looking at the quadrant. We look at hazard risks, operational risks, we look at financial risks, we look at strategic risks, as we discussed in the previous module. The holistic approach, which is also called enterprise risk management, examines all areas of the business. It encompasses the analysis of business processes and organizational decisions. It looks at all possible results, and holistic risk identification, holistic risk management involves collaboration of internal and external stakeholders to identify and treat risks. And of course, the holistic approach has been aided by technology. Advances in technology provide risk managers with more tools to analyze data. Also allows for better tracking of safety and the movement of people and products. Organizations can now assess the potential outcomes of a wider scope of activities, and that can help the organization minimize business risk. In addition, it can actually help turn risks into gains, into profits. Managing risk involves looking at not only what losses could occur, but now it involves also looking at what types of gains can be derived by taking on risk. We mentioned the risk quadrants before. Let's go through them again real quick. We do, of course, have hazard risk, but enterprise-wide risk management involves not only hazard risk, but it also involves strategic risk. Strategic risk is risk associated with long-term goals and management decisions. For example, a company deciding to create a new product. Let's say a toy company decides to create a new product. That's an example of strategic risk. The time and cost uncertainties of creating that product can turn out to be a disaster, or it could wind up causing the company to have exponential profits. That's strategic risk. We also have operational risk. That's risk associated with policies, procedures, and systems. And if you look at your handout for the risk quadrants, operational risk involves people risk, process risk, systems risk, and external events risk. We also have financial risk, which is risk associated with financial activities. Credit risk, price risk, also includes market risk. Taking risks is fundamentally necessary for growth. The management of risks can sometimes be relatively straightforward. It can sometimes be complex. For example, when it comes to managing financial risk, it may be relatively straightforward and may just involve the monitoring of cash flow and interest rates. Or in some situations, it may be complex. It could involve managing foreign exchange transactions, could also involve the cost of raw materials, depreciation of assets, loans, and liquidity. The holistic approach to risk management can uncover some inconsistencies about ways that organizations are managing risks across the risk quadrant. For example, we may have an organization that's exposing itself to millions of dollars of losses as far as financial risk is concerned, but only exposing itself to $50,000 worth of losses as far as hazard risk is concerned. enterprise-wide risk management, holistic risk management, can reveal some of the discrepancies, some of the inconsistencies in the amount of risk being taken on in the different risk quadrants. Risk management has benefited from advances in technology, and advances in technology have given organizations an increased ability to capture, store, and analyze data. We talked about that in Module 1. Technology can uncover previously imperceptible risk factors. Predictive modeling actually combines better data with better software that can analyze and predict outcomes. And smart products can collect and share data instantly and often wirelessly. We've mentioned many of these devices before in this course, and let's go through a few Internet of Things devices that generate data that's needed for modeling. One is telematics. We've mentioned that a couple of times. Telematics can create a picture of an insured's driving habits, and as we said before, it measures acceleration, speed, braking, and distance. We have sensors in buildings. Those can monitor noise, heat, and the quality of air. Drones can access difficult-to-reach areas. Smartphones can connect with others through text, through voice. Health trackers, those measure steps and heart rates as well. Robots can assess damage and monitor hazards, and cameras can be used to inspect buildings and other structures for signs of erosion and various other risks as well. There are various risk measures that risk managers use to assess interactions between risk factors. We'll talk about some of those measures now. We'll go through a few more later on in this course. The first one is covariance. And the first thing I want to mention about these different risk factors is you will not have to calculate correlation, covariance, or variance. Those are somewhat difficult calculations. They're statistical calculations, and that's not really what this exam is about. But you do have to understand what covariance is used for, and covariance is a measure of how two random risk variables will change in relation to each other. For example, let's say that I have a firm, it's an accounting firm, and what we do is we file tax returns. I have preparers that prepare returns, and I notice that the more training that they get, the fewer mistakes that they have on the returns. So the more training, the less mistakes. What that results in is a negative covariance. There's an opposite relationship. The higher the training, the lower the number of errors. That's a negative covariance. So there could be a positive covariance, a negative covariance. In my example, that was a negative covariance. The covariance is actually used to calculate correlation, and the correlation represents the strength of that association between two variables. We have for investment, sometimes we use what's called the correlation coefficient, and that measures how well or poorly two stocks or two other investments move together or move opposite of each other. So covariance, correlation, those show how two types of assets or investments move in relation to each other. We also have what's called the variance. The variance shows how far apart the numbers are in relation to the average. So for example, let's say that I own a stock, and last year the stock had a rate of return of 9%, 2 years ago the stock had a rate of return of 11%, the average for the 2 years is 10%. And let's say that there's another stock that last year had a rate of return of 5%, and 2 years ago it had a rate of return of 15%, well that average is also 10%. So both investments had an average rate of return of 10%. However, the stock that had the 5% and 15% returns over the 2 years, that had a larger variance. In other words, the difference between the high and low returns and the average, that was a larger variance with that particular stock, which means there's more risk associated with that particular stock. There are reasons that risk professionals measure correlation and covariance. Usually these correlation amounts and covariance amounts, they're used in the area of investments, but they're also used by risk managers. And these are some reasons. to identify relationships among various sources of risk, to determine the degree of uncertainty in a risk portfolio, to prioritize investments in loss control, to optimize risk financing for multiple sources of risk, and to evaluate the effectiveness of risk management programs. So even though when we think of correlation and covariance, we often think of those in the area of investments, it's also good to think of these in the area of risk management. Another way of measuring risk variables is through Monte Carlo simulation or Monte Carlo analysis. Monte Carlo is used in the area of investments and when planning for retirement, but it can also be used in the area of risk management because it can be used to predict outcomes. Monte Carlo is a statistical computer model, and it simulates the effects that various types of uncertainty may have on a process. When I've seen Monte Carlo simulations, I've seen them done with respect to a retirement plan. And what would happen is a computer can run thousands of different scenarios to determine what the likelihood of someone's retirement is for being successful or for failing. Monte Carlo involves a random selection of values for variables, and the results are assembled into probability distributions representing possible outcomes. Monte Carlo can be used by a risk manager to identify strengths or weaknesses in the risk management program itself. So let's do a couple of practice questions. Which one of the following statements is correct regarding types of IoT devices currently in use? High-definition cameras connect with others through text and voice. No, that's actually a smartphone that does that, so A is false. Drones measure heart rate and sleep patterns. Well, no, those are health trackers that do that. What about C? Telematics create a picture of an insured's driving habits. That's a true statement. C is our answer. D, sensors assess damage and monitor hazards and environmental conditions. Robots actually do that. So C is our answer for this one. Telematics create a picture of an insured's driving habits. Prime Processing Plant is reviewing its risk management approach. During a meeting with company executives, the risk manager presents data indicating that as employee training increases, on-the-job accidents decrease. This relationship is known as A, and we have negative covariance, positive variance, random correlation, and strategic risk. If you remember my example, I mentioned that as training increases for my tax return preparers, their number of errors declines. That was a negative covariance in that example, and this is the same thing. As we have training for employees on-the-job accidents decrease, that represents a negative covariance, a negative relationship, so A is our answer. Let's talk about a few ways that we can identify risks for an organization as a team. The team approach can help identify additional risks that we didn't know existed and can also reveal how these risks are connected. There are various types of team approaches to risk identification. We're going to go through each one of them separately. There's facilitated workshops, Delphi technique, scenario analysis, HAZOP, and SWOT. The technique should be chosen based on the specific project and process being analyzed. Let's go through each one of these. And we'll start off with facilitated workshops. In a facilitated workshop, the facilitator administers the risk workshop. The facilitator is a neutral party that is just guiding the workshop. The facilitator is not trying to steer the group in any particular direction. They're just running the meeting. These facilitated workshops propel the group to achieve its goal. The group discussion can help identify risks in a dynamic way. The facilitator should initiate a discussion or brainstorming session, and this allows ideas to flow freely from participants. And then the facilitator, if necessary, can set up some follow-up workshops if the facilitator deems that it's necessary to do so. The facilitated workshops can be somewhat time-consuming. They can be expensive if it involves getting a lot of people together at a particular time. But it is a good technique to get ideas to flow among group members. The workshop should include representatives from diverse groups within the organization, and that could lead to a discussion of the interconnectedness of the various risks of the organization. That would be very valuable. The facilitated workshop technique can be used for a specific project, but it can also be used to identify risks that affect the overall organization objectives. The facilitator, even though they're neutral, they should be skilled in risk identification as well as group communication. A second team approach to identifying risks is Delphi technique. The Delphi technique uses the opinions of a select group of experts to identify risks. What typically happens is a survey is created, and the survey is given to the experts. The experts respond to the survey, and when they respond, it's anonymous, so nobody can see anybody else's answers to the survey. Once the survey is completed, once round one is completed, the answers, the responses to the survey are then shared with the group, and then after that, we start a second round with that same survey. The same questions are then submitted to experts again, who are asked to consider revising their answers based on the results that were reported to the group after the first round. We do mention here that two rounds of queries are usually submitted. The word usually is key here because sometimes Delphi techniques may involve more than two rounds of surveys. It could be three, four, five rounds of surveys. It just depends on what's considered necessary. But what happens is a survey is released, anonymously answered, and then the results are shared. That's round one, and then we go through that process again. The Delphi technique was originally used to forecast new developments, such as innovation in technology. However, it's currently used for a wide range of projects and processes. And the reason it's used is because there are a lot of benefits of this technique. For example, it's more cost-effective than a facilitated workshop. It usually eliminates group bias because the responses that are given to the survey are anonymous, and it encourages participants to give honest opinions. However, there is one disadvantage that you do need to know for your exam, and one disadvantage of the Delphi technique is that the experts' opinions may be limited to their current thinking. Let's say an organization is considering producing a new product, the current expert opinion may not be as useful as the opinion of the potential product users. So that's a limitation of the Delphi technique. A third team technique for identifying risks is scenario analysis. Scenario analysis identifies risks and predicts the potential consequences. Those outcomes, those consequences are not limited to just property damage and bodily injury. Let's say that the risk that's been identified is windstorm. Under scenario analysis, of course, we would consider windstorm damage to a building as well as flood damage to a building, but we'd also consider other types of risks, such as business interruption and customer relation disruption as well. So we'd look at various different outcomes and consequences. Scenario analysis can help identify a range of potential consequences and prioritize risks. The organization should assemble an internal cross-functional team to gain a broader view of a risk's potential consequences. For example, if there is a windstorm, the operations manager may be concerned about flood damage to the building. The legal team may be concerned about a chemical spill that leaks into the floodwaters. And the financial team may be concerned about the cost of raw materials increasing tremendously after a windstorm and flood. So getting the different teams in the organization together is very helpful with respect to scenario analysis. HAZOP is another team approach to identifying risks. HAZOP is a comprehensive review of a process or system. HAZOP stands for Hazard and Operability Study. That's where we get HAZOP. What happens is a team of subject matter experts and stakeholders, they identify the risks together and recommend a solution. This technique is primarily used to design complex scientific systems such as those used in mechanical and engineering operations. However, it can be adapted to analyze certain organizational strategies as well. There is a process to implement HAZOP. We start by subdividing the project into small components. Then we review each component to identify the risks of that component. We identify the cause and outcomes for each risk, develop a solution for each risk, and then ensure the solution works and reevaluate if necessary. And this is very important for your exam. You may want to highlight this. HAZOP is ideal for projects and systems where virtually all risks must be eliminated. Let's highlight that. All risks must be eliminated. And the reason for that is because HAZOP is a comprehensive analysis and it involves experts on the subject at hand. And so this is a great way of identifying all the risks that we need to eliminate. And the last team approach to identifying risks is SWOT analysis. SWOT analysis is a team approach that is useful in analyzing a new product or project. That stands for strengths, weaknesses, opportunities, and threats. So what we're looking at is the strengths and weaknesses of an organization, which involves us looking internally at the organization. And we also look at opportunities and threats, which involves looking outside the organization at the external environment. Strengths and weaknesses considers organizational assets and other internal factors. Strengths include product quality, technology, and customer loyalty. Weaknesses include turnover, high costs, and absence of key skills. Different team members may analyze different elements under SWOT analysis. For example, the marketing group might look at the opportunities and threats of the organization. The research group may analyze the strengths and weaknesses. The strengths and weaknesses, though, look at internal factors. The opportunities and threats are determined and evaluated by looking at the external environment. Opportunities might be presented by new markets, possible acquisition targets, or a reduction in competition. Threats might include new competitors, economic downturns, even increases in taxes, or changes in consumer taste. Once the SWOT analysis has been completed, managers can then develop strategies. So let's do a couple of practice questions. Which one of the following is a disadvantage of the Delphi technique? It is generally the most expensive team approach to risk identification. Now, we mentioned before that Delphi was cost-effective, certainly more cost-effective than a facilitated workshop, so A is false. Its use is limited to forecasting new developments. Originally, that was the case, but there's much more broad use of the Delphi technique now, so B is false. Participants are unlikely to give an honest opinion because results are shared with the group. Eventually, the results are shared, but initially, when the survey is given, it's anonymous, so C is false. D, the experts' opinions may be limited to their current thinking on a subject. That is a disadvantage of the Delphi technique, so D is our answer. Which one of the following team approaches to risk identification is ideal for projects where virtually all risks must be eliminated? We mentioned this before. We said with HAZOP, it's an ideal approach when virtually all risks must be eliminated. So A is our answer. Now that we've talked about risk identification, for the rest of this module, we're going to be focusing on risk analysis. Risks must be analyzed before a treatment plan can be created. So let's talk about risk analysis. In order to properly handle a risk, an organization must understand the source of that risk and also must understand possible consequences as well as likelihood. We talked about both consequences and likelihood in the previous module. If you remember, consequences are the effects of an occurrence, and those can be either positive or negative. And likelihood is a qualitative estimate of the certainty with which the outcome of an event can be predicted. We said that likelihood was very similar to probability, except probability involves the law of large numbers, whereas likelihood does not. But in order to understand a risk, we have to understand the possible consequences, we have to understand the likelihood. And after identifying a risk, the organization should note the range of possible consequences and the probability of each. Very important to analyze risks. You might know that there's a risk that your house could be subject to a fire, but it doesn't help knowing that your home could suffer that fire damage without knowing where the fire could come from, how likely it is that a fire will occur, and how to prevent that fire. So let's talk a little bit about different ways that we can assess risk. Risk assessment may be qualitative, quantitative, or some combination. It depends on the type of risk and the organization's needs. Qualitative analysis measures a risk by the significance of consequences, and it may be a very straightforward way of analyzing a risk, and it could involve opinions and a rating such as high, medium, or low risk. So this is relatively straightforward, but there is a downside of qualitative analysis, and that is that opinions may differ. What you think is a high risk might be something that I think is a low risk. So what's really important with qualitative analysis is that we must have a clear explanation in writing as to how these various ratings are determined. How do we determine if something is a high risk or a medium risk or a low risk? Quantitative analysis assigns values to consequences. Unfortunately, quantitative analysis may not be feasible for every risk. For example, if an organization lacks historical data about a risk, quantitative analysis is probably not going to be feasible. Both qualitative and quantitative approaches to risk assessment may include estimates of probability. The probabilities are usually based on historical data relating to occurrences, and we'll go through some probability calculations later on in this course. Instead of probabilities, though, sometimes the approaches are based on expert opinions. Several structured processes have been developed to incorporate expert opinions, and that includes items such as decision tree analysis and event tree analysis. We'll also talk about these later on in this course. By the way, there is a handout that came with your study materials that shows an event tree. If you want to look at that real quick, we will talk about that later. And as far as assessing controls, an organization must examine the effectiveness of its risk control measures. Risk control represents either a decision to act or a decision not to act in an attempt to reduce either the frequency or severity, or both the frequency and severity of losses. Risk control techniques include things like loss reduction, risk avoidance, loss prevention, which lessens the frequency of a risk. In this case, we want to look at our risk control measures and determine how effective they are. We want to assess our risk controls. Risk control, once again, is either an act or a decision not to act that reduces the frequency and/or severity of losses. Every risk control technique should be identified, and the organization should verify the effectiveness of each technique. So let's do a practice question. The conscious act or decision not to act that reduces the frequency and/or severity of a loss or makes the loss more predictable is known as, and we have risk avoidance, risk prevention, risk control, and risk transfer. And we can go ahead and eliminate risk transfer because there are different ways of treating risks. One of them is risk control, which has several different measures that we could choose from. And we have risk transfer, which is, in many cases, using insurance to transfer a risk to another party. In this case, we can get rid of risk transfer because risk transfer is not used to reduce the frequency and or severity of a loss. And so that leaves us with risk avoidance, risk prevention, and risk control. And there really isn't a risk prevention. There is loss prevention, but not risk prevention. So we're left with risk avoidance and risk control. And what we're looking for is either a conscious act or a decision not to act. Risk avoidance is a decision not to act. However, a decision, a conscious act, or a decision to act is not risk avoidance. And so the best answer is C, risk control. Risk avoidance is a type of risk control measure, but risk avoidance is only the decision not to act. So this particular question is looking for the broad definition, the conscious act or decision not to act that reduces the frequency and or severity of a loss, and that is risk control. So C is our answer. Let's talk about accident analysis. Learning how an accident happened can help us prevent that type of accident in the future. In order to understand an accident, we need to understand the cause of the accident, and there are generally three categories of causes of accidents. One of them is poor management, a second category is safety policy, and the third category is personal or environmental factors. Understanding that there are three categories of causes of accidents, there are different approaches to understanding what caused an accident. So let's go through each of those approaches. We'll talk about each one separately, but the approaches are the sequence of events theory, which is sometimes called domino theory, energy transfer theory, technique of operations review, or TOR approach, change analysis, and job safety analysis. Let's go through each one of those. And we'll start with sequence of events theory, which is sometimes called domino theory. That proposes that the following factors, in order, can cause a chain of events that eventually lead to an injury. And the first domino in the chain is ancestry and social environment. Social environment can include a lot of things. Ancestry can include a lot of things and can even include psychological disorders. The next link in the chain is the fault of a person, and that can include a violent temper, impulsiveness. A lot of different things could be included under fault of person. Then we have an unsafe act or hazard, and then that leads to an accident, and then the accident results in an injury. And the idea here with this theory is that each link leads to the next link, and so if you can take out one of these first four links, you won't have an injury. This theory is most applicable to situations with human control. So this theory really doesn't apply to natural disasters. This is not a good theory to analyze the cause of a natural disaster. We want accidents that are within human control. A second theory of accident causation is energy transfer theory, and that indicates the basic cause of accidents is energy that's out of control. The approach to preventing accidents focuses on controlling released energy or reducing the harm caused by the energy, and in order to do that, we have a couple of different strategies. For example, maintaining safe distances between objects. For example, we can make sure we're separating motor vehicles from pedestrians appropriately. Also, another strategy is ensuring objects can slow themselves or stop completely. For example, we can make sure that elevators have emergency brakes. So these are some strategies under the energy transfer theory. A third strategy of accident causation is the TOR, or Technique of Operations Review, approach. And that focuses on preventing accidents caused by poor management. So the key thing to highlight here is that if there's an accident under the TOR approach, it assumes it's because of the fault of management. It attempts to identify faults in management. It groups faults into different categories, such as things like inadequate coaching, poor supervision, the failure to take responsibility. And the technique also helps identify accident causes and suggests corrective actions. So this implies that it's management's fault if an accident occurs. The basic principles are that unsafe acts and conditions are symptoms of something wrong in the management system. Certain circumstances can produce an injury. Safety should be managed like any other organizational function. Management should set achievable goals with regards to safety and should lead the path to achieving those goals. Procedures for accountability must be specified, and the function of safety is to locate and define operational errors. So this puts the blame on management if there's an accident. Another method is change analysis. Change analysis projects the effects a system change is likely to have on an existing system. It asks a series of what-if questions and projects the consequences for all feasible combinations of changes. Let's say that we have a company and our normal work week for employees is a 5-day work week, 8 hours per day. But we're thinking about changing that to a 4-day work week where people are working 10 hours a day. What we might do is try and figure out what the consequences of that will be. We could ask questions such as, what will be the reduction or increase in accidents if people are commuting by train or by car and we're changing their work hours and their work days? We would ask various questions. Change analysis can also apply to various combinations of changes in systems. Let's say we're an auto manufacturer and we're thinking about not only changing the cars from gas to hybrid, but also changing the weight of the car. We're actually making multiple changes to the car, and we want to ask a series of what-if questions to try and figure out how those changes will affect our risks. And finally, we have job safety analysis. That dissects a repetitive task to determine potential hazards. Job safety analysis is one of the most universally applicable techniques for analyzing accidents. Each job is broken down into steps, and the hazards at each step are identified and controls are defined. Once again, this is best suited for repetitive tasks, such as a job on an assembly line or a job in an office where workers are sitting at their desks most of the day. So let's do a couple of practice questions. Which one of the following is an approach to accident causation that views the cause of accidents to be a result of management's shortcomings? And we have root cause analysis, technique of operations review, change analysis, and job safety analysis. And as we said before, technique of operations review, or TOR, that is the one that essentially places the blame on management. So B is our answer. Daryl works in a warehouse for ABC Company and often exhibits signs of poor impulse control and a resistance to the safety practices of the company. At the end of his shift one day, he leaves without properly shutting down the equipment he was working with. During the subsequent shift, the equipment overheated and exploded, injuring another worker. This example best illustrates the accident causation theory of the domino theory, which is also called the sequence of events theory, energy transfer theory, technique of operations review, or TOR approach, and job safety analysis. And if you look at what happened here, we did have an injury, we did have an accident. What led to that, though? It was a sequence of events, wasn't it? It mentions that he often exhibits signs of poor impulse control. That could be a result of ancestry. Maybe he has a psychological disorder, and that led to impulsiveness, and that led to an unsafe act, which led to the accident, which then led to the injury. Like dominoes, sequence of events is what caused this. And so the answer to this question is domino theory. A is our answer. Let's wrap up Module 3 by talking about root cause analysis. Root cause analysis, or RCA, enables a risk management professional to find factors that contributed to an accident. It looks beyond obvious causes. Let's say, for example, that a customer slips and falls at a restaurant in a puddle of water. Some might say the puddle of water cause them to slip and fall, but root cause analysis looks beyond the puddle of water itself. It would ask questions such as, what led to the formation of the puddle? Or why didn't anybody notice the puddle before somebody slipped on it? It addresses factors at the beginning of a chain of events leading to an accident, and it may make it possible to limit the probability of a similar accident in the future. So looking at our restaurant example, what are some potential root causes? Well, maybe an employee failed to follow the safety protocols that indicated the employee is only supposed to mop the floor after the restaurant has closed. Maybe they failed to do that, and that's what caused the water to puddle and someone to slip on it. Or maybe the employee was not properly trained to remove the water. That could be a root cause as well. There are four characteristics of root causes, and you need to know these for your exam. The first one is that there needs to be a specific underlying clause, specific, not general. For example, saying operator error, that's too vague. That's not a root cause. What we should say instead is the operator removed the safety valve. That's an example of a specific underlying cause, the operator removing the safety valve, not operator error. Second characteristic is that the root cause can be reasonably identified. We need to be able to figure out why, in this case, the operator removed that safety valve. Must be expressed as something that can be modified. So a weather condition, a storm, that's not a root cause because they're beyond human control. It has to be something that can be modified for it to be a root cause, and the root cause can be prevented with appropriate recommendations. These are the characteristics of root causes. There are several different RCA approaches. You don't need to know too much about these. There isn't a lot of detail in the textbook. We'll just go through this very quickly. There's the safety-based approach, which originated from accident analysis, the production-based approach that evolved from quality control, process-based, which includes business processes, the failure-based approach originated from failure analysis, and that's used primarily in engineering and maintenance. And we also have the systems-based approach that combines other approaches with change and risk management. So these are some of the approaches that are used for root cause analysis. Let's go through the steps of root cause analysis. The first step in the RCA process is to collect the data. After collecting the data, we then chart causal factors, and those are agents that directly result in one event causing another. And there could be multiple causal factors. It could be poor maintenance, a missing machine guard, several different factors. After identifying the causal factors, we want to identify the root cause. We can use mapping or flowcharting to help us determine the underlying reasons for each causal factor, and that can include things such as poor training. And then we finally determine and implement the recommendations. Root cause analysis is typically used after an event has occurred. However, it can also be used to predict events. Organizations can learn to solve problems before they become major events using root cause analysis. So let's do a practice question. Which one of the following statements is correct regarding the characteristics of root causes? We mentioned the different characteristics before. A root cause is expressed as a general underlying cause. If you remember, it has to be specific, not general. So A is false. A root cause sometimes cannot be prevented. A root cause, for it to be a root cause, has to be something that can be prevented through effective recommendations. If it can't be prevented, it's not a root cause. So B is false. C, a root cause is anything that causes an event to occur. Now, we mentioned it has to be something that can be modified. For example, a natural disaster is not a root cause. So it's not anything that could be a root cause. It has to be something that's modifiable. So C is false. A root cause can be reasonably identified. That is true, so D is our answer, and that concludes Module 3.